Monday nights, up late. Broadcasting from stolen land. Satellite skies. Satellite skies. Satellite skies. Highlighting DIY and autonomous politics, music, and subculture with a different theme each week.
Hello and welcome back on Writing Home. It's Saturday morning, 9 a.m. on my clock, and you've tuned in to Writing Home on Satellite Skies at 3CR 855 a.m. This and every following segment will be recorded on Wurundjeri Wyvern country. We pay our respects to the original owners of this land, the Wurundjeri Wyvern people, as well as their elders, past, present and emerging. طفل وحده والليالي ورصاص من حوله وجنود وقف الطفل والحجارة أكوام وعيناه عزمة وصمود وعيناه عزمة وصمود
found in a mountain of parts. Netanyahu told you just another child of the dark. Clear it's gonna take much more than thousands to march. More than a speech, more than a poem, more than a track of music. Gonna take more than a sit down with Bassem Youssef. Even bringing back ambassadors isn't Atlas useless. Long as you pump oil for Apaches and the tanks they're using. Freedom just beyond reach for people you cannot see. He's wheezing and cannot breathe and screaming through the concrete. Looking for his four children. Leave structures that I wouldn't want to call buildings. My fingers pointed at this government. You all killed them. Tell me that you wouldn't take up arms if those were your children. Let me make the factor clear. The bombs were manufactured here, and they want the land as theirs because of natural gas in there. Feel death in the atmosphere while we hapless stand and stare. And a little boy begs for his brother's strand of hair. Truth is, I don't know how anyone can live after digging for their dead kids buried under bricks. Israel is a terror state. Terrorists that terrorize. I testify my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, free, 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 free. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, free, 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 free.
They bomb churches and paramedics, it's hurting. The panic spreading, hospitals where the doctors do C-sections, no anesthetics. The pressure is manifesting, humanity stands connected. Masses seem apathetic and actually just accept it. When our grandchildren ask us, what did we do to stop it? I'm determined to say, I did more than make music on it. That's why we shut down arms factories, you can try stopping us. Palestine action's the opposite of white phosphorus. We tell them on the television, but they never listen. Tell Piers Morgan that resistance isn't terrorism. They want them fled dead or missing, death or prison, endless killing. I seen a father hold his baby up, the head was missing. Imagine demolition of home where your parents live in. Kings won't say a thing, but at least we know that Yemen's with them. Ethnic cleansing, it ain't hard to see the stages, but Gaza is a graveyard of the invaders. Ears close to the savagery, clear though when there's clarity. The journalists and doctors are heroes of humanity. As sordid and as gory as this story is for now, and they depopulating Gaza for Ben-Gurion's canal. Israel is a terror state, terrorists that terrorize. I testify my television, televise, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
That was Palestine Will Never Die by Loki and May Khalil.
So it's up to us, the people. We need a treaty in this country. We need the end to the war in this country. And the only way we can do that is through a peace treaty. Not the one you see in Victoria, not the one you see in Queensland, not the one you see in the Northern Territory, because they talk treaty and still lock our people up. They still kill our people. They still desecrate our land and our water. A treaty means peace. A treaty means equality, and a treaty means justice. Thank you.
You're listening to Radical Radio on 3CR, 855 on your AM dial, 3CR digital, and podcasting and streaming on 3cr.org.au.
Hello everyone, welcome back on Writing Home. This is Madhvi. I'll be here every Saturday at 9 a.m. taking you through some feminist readings from the Global South. We'll be reading thinkers and revolutionaries like Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, Savitri Bai Phule, Rafia Zakaria, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and various others. For today, I've picked The Seven Necessary Sins for Women and Girls by Mona El-Tahawi. This was actually a surprise gift from Amplify Bookstore. Amplify Bookstore is a bookstore owned by women of color to amplify BIPOC authors and their works. Next song I'll be playing is Hijabi by Mona Heather.
What the hair look like? Bet the hair look nice. Don't that make you sweat? Don't that feel too tight? Yo, what your hair look like? Bet your hair look nice. How long your hair is? You need to get your life. You only see Oriental. You steady working that dental. You popping off at the lip and run your mouth like a treadmill. Not your exotic vacation. I'm bored with your fascination. I need that paper, paper, paper if you want education. All around the world, love women every shade of
Swag, swag. ladies. We was born in the 80s, so pretty like the Euphrates, and party like some Kuwaitis, deeper than some diplomas, current like some hot yoga, taking back the misnomers and teleporting through trauma, teleporting through trauma, teleporting through trauma. I've been stacking my karma, Nefertiti, no drama, make a feminist planet, woman haters get banished, covered up or not, don't ever take us for granted. All around the world, love women. These mixers, these hippies, these prissies, these Sufis, these dreadies, these Sunnis, these Shiris, Yemenis, Somalis, Lebanese, Pakistanis, these Sudis, Sudanis, Iraqis, Punjabis, Afghanis, Yazidis, Khadijis, Indonesians, Egyptians, Canadians, Algerians, Nigerians, Americans, Libyans, Tunisians, Palestinians, hidden beyond the Mekong and Laos, Senegalese and Burkina Faso.
Defying, disobeying, and disrupting the patriarchy. I wrote this book with enough rage to fuel a rocket. I knew I had to write it while I was still high on the glory of beating up a man who had sexually assaulted me. Who was this woman I had become? Who looks men in the eye, seizing their gaze with my fury, until their fear tells me they understand not to fuck with me. I wanted to figure her out. For years, I had been shedding shame and gaining fury. For years, I had been thumping away at patriarchy. Like a piñata, hanging tantalizing just out of reach. It was stubborn, but by tenacity and ferocity became my ladder. This book is my instruction manual for smashing that piñata. Once upon a time, in 1982, I was a 15-year-old girl sexually assaulted twice at Islam's holiest city in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, as I performed Hajj, the Muslim pilgrimage that is the fifth pillar of Islam. I had never been sexually assaulted before. And I froze and burst into tears. I was ashamed and traumatized, and most critically, I was silent. It took me years before I could tell anyone what had happened when I was on my first Hajj. I did not know of the writer and poet Audre Lorde's work when I was assaulted, but as my feminism grew, I began to understand what she meant when she said, "Your silence will not protect you." And so, I began to speak. The first time I shared my Hajj story, it was with an international group of women in Cairo. An Egyptian Muslim woman took me aside and warned me to stop sharing what had happened in front of foreigners because it would make Muslims look bad. I told her, it was not I but the men who assaulted me who make Muslims look bad. The next time I spoke publicly about my assault, it was in Arabic on an Egyptian primetime television show in 2013. The segment producer told me I was the first person who had ever shared a story like this on Egyptian television. It was such a taboo that he was lucky he still had a job after the backlash that followed. As I continued to quietly share with fellow Muslim women my experience of sexual assault during the Hajj, the story started to flow, with more and more women saying me too. All those years of silence were for the same reason we thought it was impossible that anyone else had gone through a violation at such a sacred place. I also had to mature into the understanding that the men who assaulted me had abused the sanctity of a sacred space to ensure the silence of their victim. They knew that no one would believe me. I wanted a permanent record of what had happened to me, so I wrote about my sexual assault in my 2015 book, Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. Muslim women from all over the world wrote to tell me that reading about my experience made them cry. 2 years later, as Muslims from around the world were again preparing to converge in Mecca for the Hajj, I posted a series of tweets about being sexually assaulted during the pilgrimage because I wanted to warn fellow Muslim women. Until the Saudi authorities who administer the holy sites take concrete steps to ensure that female pilgrims can perform pilgrimage free from sexual harassment and assault, we must protect each other. And so there I was at my computer in February 2018, sharing once again that I had been sexually assaulted twice during pilgrimage in 1982 to support Sabika Khan, a Pakistani woman who had shared on Facebook her own assault in Mecca. I asked fellow Muslim women who felt safe enough to share their own experience of sexual harassment or assault, either while performing Hajj or in a Muslim sacred place. I added a hashtag to my post, hashtag MosqueMeToo. Over 2 days, my Twitter thread was retweeted and liked thousands of times. It was shared in Indonesian, Arabic, Turkish, French, German, Spanish, and Farsi. I had never before seen such a response. At first, men demanded, "Why didn't you make more of a fuss?" Soon after, men went into full gaslighting mode. Anything to persuade me I had not experienced what I had experienced, or else questioning my character as a way to undermine my story. I could write a whole other book called Things You Will Hear When You Say You've Been Sexually Assaulted. Observe. You're too ugly to be sexually assaulted. You're being paid to do this. You just want to be famous. You just want attention. You want to destroy Islam. You want to make Muslim men look bad. You are a whore. You imagined it. It was crowded. Why didn't you report it? You waited all that time. Why? What do you expect? Sexual assault happens everywhere. Why aren't you talking about sexual assault in New Zealand? You should have yelled and made a fuss. For 5 days, women from around the world had shared with me their most harrowing experiences of sexual harassment and assault at pilgrimage or other sacred spaces. Reading their stories undid something that had broken in me as that young pilgrim in 1982 that I had thought I had stitched together. I had not fully grasped the magnitude of being sexually assaulted at the site toward which Muslims pray 5 times a day. The experience of telling stories and especially men's refusal to believe them was as if I was standing in pouring rain. I could feel it drenching every part of me only to hear the weather forecast on television confidently explaining that it was sunny and dry with not a drop of rain expected. Being forced to absorb the terrible violation of being sexually assaulted, but also to be robbed of a spiritual experience that so many long to experience, forced me to connect that violation with the many other violations I have been subjected to. How could all of that have happened to me? How have I absorbed it, been forced to accept it so that I could go on every day? And how had I learned to get on with my life? For one night, I wanted some respite from that reckoning. So 5 days after I launched hashtag MosqueMeToo, my beloved and I went to a club in Montreal to dance it off, to revel in the sensual delight of moving my body, to music, in the hope that all those beats per minute would be a balm to my traumatized heart. And there, in the middle of a crowded and sweaty dance floor, at age 50, I felt a hand on my ass. I had exactly two thoughts. You've got to be fucking kidding me. And this is still happening? I remembered my 15-year-old self at Hajj, covered from head to toe with just my face and hands showing. Now, on the dance floor in Montreal, I was wearing a tank top and jeans. It had not matter, hijab or tank top. A man's hand still found me. And I was done. But unlike in 1982, when I could not turn around to find my assaulter, I immediately spotted my creep, who had started to walk away. As if on autopilot, I followed him and tugged so hard at the back of his shirt that he stumbled. When he fell, I sat on top of him and I punched and punched and punched his face. Once was not enough. And each time I punched him, I yelled, "Don't you ever touch a woman like that again." While I was punching the man who had assaulted me, I could see from my peripheral vision my beloved talking to two men who had been dancing when I started beating the man and who were now preparing to pull me off my assaulter. My beloved later told me the two men had wanted to stop me from punching the man who had groped me. No, he assaulted her, he told the two men. Let's call them the chorus for patriarchy. She's got this. It had been a long time since I had experienced as much clarity as I did in those moments. I knew exactly what I was doing, defending myself, and exactly why I was doing it. I was done with men who gave themselves the right to do as they wished with my body. If at that most sacred of temples, the holiest site of my religion, I am not safe from predatory hands, where am I safe? If at that most secular of temples, a dance club, predatory man, also insist on assaulting us, where are we safe? My beloved and I went to the bar to get some water. A man who appeared to be from club management approached us and asked me to tell him what had happened. After I explained that I had beaten a man who had sexually assaulted me, he looked at my beloved and asked me, "Why didn't you let your husband take care of it?" At what age does my body belong to me? Patriarchy is so universal and normalized that it is like asking a fish, "What is water?" It enables and protects men who sexually assault women, and it demands that only other men protect us. As long as we obey and behave in ways it approves, it will protect us. And if we disobey, you can be sure that the protection will be revoked quicker than you can say patriarchy. But I don't want to be protected. I just want patriarchy to stop protecting and enabling men. I don't want to be protected. I want to be free. Regardless of whether you live in an absolute monarchy like Saudi Arabia or in a liberal democracy like Canada or United States, regardless of what your religion is or if you are atheist or secular, regardless of whether your country has been colonized or itself once colonized and exploited others, patriarchy lives everywhere. It controls how our society and institutions are organized and run. And it has legal implications for women, non-binary people and children who have less power than men. I was born in Egypt, moved to the United Kingdom when I was 7 years old, moved to Saudi Arabia when I was 15, lived in Jerusalem for 14 months as a reporter when I was in my 30s, and moved to the United States in 2000 after I married an American. My reporting and public speaking have taken me to Central and South America, Asia, Australia, Europe, and Africa. Patriarchy lives in every single one of those countries and on each continent. Whether you live in the best country to be a woman, Iceland, and neighboring Scandinavian countries, usually top those lists, or the worst, patriarchy is clear. No country has achieved political equality. Many countries have never had a female head of state. No country pays men and women equally for work they do. In every country, it is fact that most acts of domestic, intimate partner and sexual violence pose significant threats to women and girls, and that the majority of such acts are perpetrated by men. Some religions still refuse to ordain women to holy orders. And men, by and large, control and are disproportionately represented in the media, the arts, and the cultural landscapes that shape our tastes and ideas. Patriarchy is universal. Feminism must be just as universal. I want patriarchy and all who benefit from it to have the same look of terror as that man in the Montreal club, who, before he ran away, took a look at me so that he could see the woman who had dared strike back. I want patriarchy to know that feminism is rage unleashed against its centuries of crimes against women and girls around the world. Crimes that are justified by culture and tradition, and it's just the way things are. All of which are euphemisms, for this world is run by men for the benefit of men. We must declare a feminism that is robust, aggressive, and unapologetic. It is the only way to combat a patriarchy that is systemic. I also want feminism to be led by the non-white and the queer, who don't have the luxury of fighting only misogyny. We must fight the multiple systems of oppressions that patriarchy often intertwines itself with. Racism, bigotry, homophobia, transphobia, classism, ableism, and ageism. There is much work to do. After the fight at the club and astonished at how my attempt to take care of myself after the intensity of #MosqueMeToo had unfolded, I shared what had happened on Twitter under a new hashtag. #IBetMyAssaulter. All that weekend, I was icing my bruised knuckles and hearing from women around the world who sent me their #IBetMyAssaulter experiences, as with #MosqueMeToo. So many women wrote to me and said, "Me too. I was in a club, at a bus stop, in school, here, there, and #IBetMyAssaulter, much like with #MosqueMeToo. It was a global chorus of women who saw each other and recognized what it means to be done with the fuckery of patriarchy. As women sent me examples of how they had beaten their assaulters, men were showing me how easily the goalposts can move. Under #MosqueMeToo, men asked me, 'Why didn't you make more of a fuss?' Under #IBetMyAssaulter, men said, 'You made too much of a fuss. You were too violent. Don't you think you overreacted?' And more audaciously, some men asked, 'What if the situation were reversed?' As if women make a habit of groping men at clubs. As if centuries of patriarchy had not enabled and protected men's entitlement to women's bodies. And so, therefore, the situation cannot be reversed. As if the power of violence and assault had not historically always been and continues to be in the hands of men. Whatever a woman does, she will always be victim blamed. My message was clear. Women, do whatever you need to at the moment. This is self-defense. This is putting patriarchy on notice that we will fight back. This is warning patriarchy that it should fear us."
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. And don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. And please, when I go out with you, don't put me on display. 'Cause you don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay.
Say.
Welcome back on Writing Home. That was You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore. And we've been reading The Seven Necessary Sins for Women and Girls. Page 10, Defying, Disobeying and Disrupting the Patriarchy. Anger, attention, profanity, ambition, power, violence and lust. I call them sins. But of course they are not. They are what women and girls are not supposed to be or do or want. They are condemned as sins by a patriarchy that demands we acquiesce to, not destroy, its dictates. In the chapter on anger, I ask what the world would look like if girls were taught that they were volcanoes that could and should erupt to disrupt patriarchy. I examine how anger and rage are discouraged and broken out of girls, and the ways in which that anger and rage are important in the fight against patriarchy. I also ask who is allowed to be angry, and I analyze how. Depending on their race and class, some girls are punished for behavior that is tolerated in others. In my examination of attention, I insist that women and girls demand attention because we deserve it and must not shy away from it. The quickest and laziest way to discredit a woman is to accuse her of attention seeking. I explain the importance of defiantly declaring that we deserve attention and why such a declaration is a powerful tool for disrupting patriarchy's demands that we remain modest and humble. We must say fuck. In the chapter on profanity, I insist on the power of profanity as a force in disrupting, disobeying, and defying patriarchy and its rules. In understanding why profanity is off limits to women, I unpack the ways that girls are socialized into the straitjacket of being nice and polite, and recognize the absurdity of patriarchy's claim that our profane words are worse than the violence it subjects us to. Why is ambition considered a dirty word for women? Why does patriarchy teach girls and women that it is wrong to openly declare they want to be better than everybody else at something? And why, when they are better, when they are recognized as experts who are better than everybody else, must women play down or diminish their expertise and the ambition that propelled them to those levels? What is a powerful woman? In the chapter on power, I insist on differentiating between power that dismantles patriarchy from power that is used in the service of patriarchy. Patriarchy has often thrown women crumbs in return for a limited form of power that often replicates the hierarchies that patriarchy has created. We must refuse those crumbs. We must bake our own cake. And we must define power in a way that liberates us from patriarchy's hierarchies. In the chapter on violence, I examine the right of women and girls to fight back against the crimes of patriarchy. Violence is a legitimate form of resistance in struggles against colonization and occupation. It has long been accepted as just and necessary in such struggles. What about the struggle against a form of oppression that hurts half the world's population? This book is not a roadmap for making peace with patriarchy. It is a manifesto to dismantle patriarchy and to end its crimes. And finally, in examining lust, I emphasize the importance of a deceptively simple but revolutionary insistence. I own my body. Nobody else owns it, not the state, the street, or the home. Not the church, mosque, or temple. I examine the importance and the power of expressing and insisting on desire, pleasure, and sex on our own terms. wanting sex, and expressing sexuality outside the teachings of heteronormativity are about a chaos and liberation that deeply threatens patriarchy. I examine the centrality of consent and agency to challenging patriarchy's strange hold over our bodies, and how queerness appends patriarchy's insistence that it alone dictates not only who can have sex and how they can have it, but who can express desire and lust. This is a moment for those who are not rich, white, or famous to be heard. It is a moment in which we must have a reckoning with patriarchy, and in which we recognize how normalized its crimes are, as well as a reckoning with how it intersects with other forms of oppression like racism, classism, ableism, homophobia, transphobia, and bigotry. I am from many worlds and I travel between many places. Throughout this book, I will share voices and stories from across the world about the ways women and queer people yell a big fuck you to patriarchy.
Subhari aankhon mein ghoome जावा थे धूप में वो बिछड़ते कहाँ थे
That was Neend Aati Nahi by Zoe Vikaji. Next, I'll be moving on to chapter one, which is anger. I think I have a beautiful relationship with anger and I really cherish it. And I can definitely go on and on here. On how much I love anger, how much I love rage, and how my rage has given me a lot in life. My rage, I don't know, I worship, like, we have this. That was Neend Aati Nahi by Zoe Vikaji. In Angry Women, Andrea Juno introduces anger as an emotion which must be reclaimed and legitimized women's rightful, healthy expression. Anger can be a source of power, strength, and clarity, as well as a creative process. Andrea further states, women have a different, less destructive relationship to anger than men, especially since it has been a taboo expression for them. To be angry is only a pleasure if you have. Ruby Hamad in Whitey's Brown Scars says, when broader society refuses to validate women of color, it becomes vital for us to share our experiences with each other as a means of coping with these damaging stereotypes, and to help us recognize the gaslighting techniques and stereotypes that keep us in a subordinate position. Again, in Sara Ahmed's words, we become a problem when we describe a problem. I think anger, I love my relationship to rage. And it was definitely a journey of me. At first, I think feeling the guilt all through my life of being, you know, the woman who starts the fire, the girl who is too much, never enough, too much but never enough. And yeah, it took me some time because initially it was perceived as envy. That, oh, you know, your envy is gonna rob your peace. But I think eventually, as I've grown and I've had more room to think about myself, my feelings, my desires, I think all through my life, I was just not allowed to be angry. Because, of course, being angry meant that there was, you know, when you acknowledge a problem, you become a problem, just like Sara Ahmed said. And it's not even about growing up. Same stuff was applied here. I think the experience of her being, you know, an Indian woman and being silenced, that was rather, like, easily accepted by me. Because the authority here was West, Western feminism or Western feminists. And back home, I think the feeling would have rather been that, oh, when will I get out of this place? Or when will I, you know, have a partner who loves me so he can give me that safety? And not just safety, but I think I somehow growing up felt that either it was love or getting out of that place would let me have my say the way or live my life the way I want it. But the code of conduct is universal, like we've been saying here again and again. To finish up, I will read from Mona El-Tahawi's chapter 1, Anger. I honor that angry 4-year-old girl. I honor her belief that she deserved to be free of molestation, free of interruption, free of a man who believed he deserved her time and attention. She was born with a pilot light of anger, tenacious and sure of its right to flare whenever treated unjustly. I believe all girls are born with that pilot light of anger. What happens to it as they grow into women? What would the world look like if girls were taught they were volcanoes whose eruptions were a thing of beauty, a power to behold and a force not to be trifled with? What if, instead of breaking their vileness like a rancher tames a bronco, we taught girls the importance and power of being dangerous? What if we nurtured and encouraged the expression of anger in girls, the same way we encourage reading skills as necessary for their navigation of the world? What if we believed that just as reading and writing help a girl to understand the world around her and to express herself within it, expressing her anger was also a necessary tool for a girl making her way through life? Imagine a girl justifiably enraged at her mistreatment. Imagine if we acknowledged her justifiable anger so that a girl understood she would be hurt if anyone abused her, and that her anger was just as important a trait as honesty. And imagine if we taught a girl that injustice anywhere and against anyone was also worthy of anger, so that she developed a keen sense of compassion and justice and understood that injustice, whether personal or affecting others, was wrong. What kind of a woman would such a girl grow up to be? We must teach girls that their anger is a valuable weapon in defying, disobeying, and disrupting patriarchy, which pummels and kills the anger out of girls. It socializes them to be compliant, because obedient girls grow up to become obedient foot soldiers of the patriarchy. They grow up to internalize its rules, which are used to police other women who disobey. We should not let patriarchy hammer girls into passivity. Well-behaved, quiet, and calm, no more.
I bought the bed to a chopper. Kevin Deka and Safa, they should say Hoga Safa and Giddy up Nehadaka, Silver Terrangi Bata, Lakshakal Vahi Chata, Vodka Mille Parikas, Vidaya Pure Sal, Amira Haye, Notoki Sarkar Hena, Notse Banate, Abnevato Koye Star Hena, Kitneve Kar, Kuye Apas Vejankar Hena, Maki Pura Desh, Dube, Kinaya Bar Hena, Achieve the Achaya Chakasa Maldena, Analme Pani Chaye Kadere Line Nena, Zameen of me, but not the Kakar sign Lena, drugs lie. ढकेल देंगे क्राइम पे ना अकेला इंसान फिर गाड़ी तेरी चार क्यों घर में है चार फिर रूम्स तेरे आठ क्यों पैसों से नहीं बनते कुदरत से हम खास क्यों तेरी पीढ़ी का सोच वो कैसे लेंगे सांस क्यों एक तरफ आता राजू आ तेरी हंसी मेरे आंसू आ घुट घुट की क्यों सांस लूं उसे देगा क्या हिसाब
तेरा पिंजरा मजाल खाना परिंदिया ने उड़ जाना तेरा पिंजरा तेरा मुक जाना सारा लाना बाना परिंदिया ने उठ जाना तेरा
नहीं बनना मुझे स्लम डॉग मिलियनेयर, ये स्लम डॉग है मिशन पे। सिस्टम के कीड़े चोरे इतने अपने कफन पे, बचपन से छुरा रखा इन्होंने अपने गर्दन पे। पुस्तक में ये लिखते गलत, सीखते गलत, छीखते हलक, पर किसी को परवाह नहीं। ये शैतान है इंसान नहीं, धर्म के नाम पे काम वही धर्म बना इंसान नहीं। पैसों के लिए ये था सभी दिमाग लड़ा कर जान के भी, ध्यान से लगा तू कान कभी, इस्तेमाल कर तू जबान कभी। अंधे का क्यों है जान के भी, अंधे का क्यों है जान के भी। सच्चाई में तू समा कभी, अच्छाई से तू कमा कभी। इस गंद को करना साफ अभी, इस गंद को करना साफ अभी, इस गंद को करना साफ अभी। अब क्या शुद्ध एक तरफ का राज शुद्ध, क्या शुद्ध अतेरी हंसी मेरे आज शुद्ध, क्या शुद्ध अब खुद खुद की तू साथ शुद्ध, क्या शुद्ध उसे देगा क्या हिसाब तू। हां हां ओ बोलो आजादी, ओ बोलो आजादी, ओ बोलो आजादी, गिव मी फ्रीडम।
थ्री सीआर, स्टे ट्यून्ड, स्टे रैडिकल।
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now to step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
Welcome back to Writing Home. This is the first episode of a 5-part audio series on feminist readings from the Global South. Today we read The Seven Necessary Sins for Women and Girls by Mona El-Tahawi. Next week we'll be reading Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. I'll be seeing you every Saturday now at 9 a.m. It was really enjoyable to share my books with you. I'll be back next week. Till then, take care.
டம் டம் மஞ்சர டம் டம் மாத்து அடிக்கு மங்கள டம் டம் ஓல டம் டம் ஒதுக்கு டம் டம் ஓங்கி தட்டிக்கும் ஒட்டிக டம் டம் மால டம் டம் மஞ்சர டம் டம் மாத்து அடி
Been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.